This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Brandon Adamson, and we're going to be discussing some of our predictions for the 2020s. Brandon, great talking to you.
It's great to be back.
So to start things off, the big thing in the news was this whole conflict with Iran. So I don't think there's going to be any major war. I remember like 10 years ago kind of being in the Ron Paul scene, and a lot of people were saying we were going to get into a major war, and it didn't happen, and I think right now the chance is slim, but I do think like there was this moment where we came very close, and we've kind of talked about how most people in our political circle are extremely disappointed by Trump, and basically everyone, and they're supporting some kind of alternative candidate. Do you have any, like Yang or Tulsi, do you have any thoughts on the whole situation with Iran?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, I've posted quite a bit about it, but I think that the main thing is that, I mean, people are focusing on, like, whether or not it's going to turn into a major war or something. And for me, the issue is that... That it demonstrates that, like, I mean, Trump and some of the, and including some of the people in some of our own circles, that like that they just don't even really understand like what's wrong with American foreign policy, you know, because just by like, you know, engaging in this meddling and these pointless provocative actions. It just shows that like the people lack historical context, and they don't even understand like what it is we don't like about American foreign policy. Like, and this everything, just the idea of considering Iran to be an enemy is I think is just like is idiotic, because like they're only an enemy in like a. The situation is entirely self-created, because, you know, why does Iran even hate us? It's because we overthrew their democratically elected leader in the 1950s and installed the Shah, and then we propped him up for like 20 years, you know, and then they had a revolution, and everyone's like, oh, well, they held the people in our embassy hostage. Well, yeah, because, you know, we had been propping up the Shah for 20 years, and we had been using these embassies, and still do this, use these as, like, you know, places where intelligence agents and things like that are spying on these countries. So, like, what do you expect them to do? And then, even after that was over, then... we supported Saddam Hussein in Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, in which, like, I don't know, you know, over 100,000 Iranians were killed. So we support Iraq in this proxy war, and then, like, these, and then, you know, we have troops stationed in, like, every country that surrounds them and have been involved in wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, these two neighboring countries. And, you know, what do these people say? They're like, well, this guy, this general, was responsible for hundreds of deaths of U.S. servicemen in proxy wars with Iraq. Well, it's like, but they're not, an enemy with us because, like, they want to be over here in America, like, taking us over. It's because we're over there, like, meddling in their shit. So just the fact of people saying, like, oh, you guys think, like, you thought this was going to be World War III. It's like, no, I don't. But the point is that we're still over there, like, playing these same stupid games, like, after all this time. Like, you guys still just don't fucking get it.
Yeah, Trump, when he was running, he did promise a change to a more non-interventionist or semi-non-interventionist foreign policy, and it's basically, it's not so much that he's getting us into a major war, but that he's basically kept the status quo when he ran on to basically doing something, he basically ran on an alternative foreign
less
policy.
Less interventionist.
Yeah, less intervention.
And he's still talking about, you know, these sanctions and whatever, you know, let's get rid of all these stupid sanctions. And all this shit, and just like we have no business being over there, and it's like, it's just ridiculous. These people say, like, oh, well, you know, there's Iran is a danger to the region or something like that. Well, okay, well, but we're the ones that are over there meddling in their shit, and then there are also the people that said, and these are like these kind of annoying, like, kind of, like, far-right armchair, like, geostrategist people that are like, well, you know, if we leave the region, then, like, you know, Russia and China are going to move in and we're going to lose influence there. But it's like, okay, but the people there, they hate us. And so if, like, Russia and China move in, then, like, who cares? Then, like, what's going to happen is, like, they're going to be the ones that are resented, hated by the local population. Like, right now, like, all of these other countries are getting all kinds of, you know, they're able to get along with these countries fine, and they probably have better relations with them, even though, like, we're physically over there. You know, so it's like all these people that are like, oh, but, you know, if we don't have our presence there, then Russia's going to move in. And, yeah, and then what's going to happen? Like, the Russians are going to be hated like they were in Afghanistan and all these other places. Like, so... yeah, I'm fine if other countries want to start meddling in these wars and be hated there. But my guess is that when other countries do it, they don't do it in such, like, you know, they're, like, investing and doing things, like, on the periphery, you know, diplomatic stuff. They're not actually physically, like fucking threatening these countries with bombing and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, like, they'll
that.
Use...
bombing their cultural...
They'll maybe use another nation as a proxy, but they're not having, like, a full-scale invasion like we are. Or no, they're not involved in nation building.
Yeah, just, you know, just the you can have... I think that we could actually have more influence and better relations in the regions if we weren't so... up in their business, trying to influence us, like, being so pushy. You know, the way these other countries, they do it with a little bit more finesse.
What do you think about those people on social media, the dissident right types who will say, like, they're disappointed with Trump, but we have to vote for him because the Democrats will do something really insane, like double immigration to 2 million a year?
I don't know. Like, at this point, I don't even think it really matters because the, you know, well, first off, it depends, like, who the Democrats run. But, you know, I'm not really interested in voting for Trump at this point because, like, I don't feel like it's, you know, I don't want my views to be, like, associated with, like, what he's doing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to have to defend all of this 4D chess stuff. Like, if he's not, like, it's kind of funny because, like, you know, he's always been, like, pressured to disavow people like us. But, like, it's now us that are like, oh, you know, we don't want our brand to be associated with this kind of crap anymore. Like, so, I don't really care. All of the... you know, we were doing these shows 4 years ago, and since Trump is, like, all of the censorship and everything like that, all of it has gotten so much worse. And even if Democrats do, you know, give amnesty or double immigration or what, it's not like they're not, you know, Trump isn't isn't good enough on those issues for it to even like really make a difference either way.
Hypothetically, if there was a trade-off, if we had a president who was strong in immigration but lousy in foreign policy, then maybe you could accept some kind of a compromise. But the reality is really he's pretty lousy on either of both.
Yeah, he's not good enough on immigration to put up with the other, you know, with the foreign policy and like and all of his other terrible, the terrible positions. And to be honest, even just like his personality and how he articulates things, it's like, you know, it's becoming almost worse for, you know, people who want restrictive immigration policy, things like that, to have someone so crudely and poorly articulate these positions to the point where it just makes people who have them look dumber. You know, it's not like Jared Taylor or some, you know what I'm saying, like giving these speeches on these issues. It's like, you know, Trump like basically saying something stupid and just like insulting someone.
And if we're going to make predictions here, if I had to predict, I don't think Trump will be reelected. He is relatively popular among Republicans, but that doesn't matter. There's the issue of swing voters. But I think the key issue is just like the demographic trends. So the demographic trends in places in these swing states, Arizona, where you live, Florida, they've changed so much in that short period of time that because remember the last election, it was basically it was so close. So just a really modest demographic change in one of those states will tip the election. So, I mean, he could win. I'm not saying that, but if I had to guess, odds are leaning in favor of the Democrats.
I completely agree because the demographic situation has changed enough to flip some of those swing voters, and he also doesn't have the kind of energy, you know, promoting him in like these kind of like the really intelligent online activists. Like he has like, you know, the memes and all of that.
There actually were some cool Trump memes in 2016, but the current MAGA memes or KAGA memes are really lame.
Yeah, they're totally lame, and like, you know, the closest thing that he has to a kind of I want to say like a kind of like an edgier grassroots kind of support is like some of like the Groiper stuff and like the Nick Fuentes stuff. That's kind of where there's at least some energy, but it's nothing compared to what it was in 2016. Now, I still think it's possible that he can win. I think it depends like who runs against him. You know, I think if it's like Bernie, then, you know, he has no chance. But if it's someone like Biden or like Elizabeth Warren or just someone, I mean, like, I wouldn't underestimate the Democrats to put someone that's just so bad, you know, that's like decides to make the issue of like, trans rights or something like the centerpiece of their campaign. Like all they really have to do is push some kind of working class stuff and some like a restrictionist foreign policy, like even just which at this point isn't difficult to say because they Trump has actually ceded that issue because the Democrats had squandered their credibility on the non-interventionist stuff because of Libya and the stuff that Obama and Hillary was doing, you know, continuation of the war in Afghanistan and you know, overthrowing the government in Libya and the troops in Syria. So the right, like, and Trump had an opening there to kind of reclaim the mantle of non-intervention, you know, going back to like maybe like, you know, some Eisenhower era foreign policy or something like that, or something more realist. And he's completely squandered that. So now he can't run as like a non-interventionist when he's like, you know, he's ceded those issues back. So where now you have even Bernie, saying like, you know, spouting this anti-war stuff when just like a year ago or something, like Bernie was like, you know, he was talking about like, you know, like supporting some of these actions against Syria and things like that in the Middle East. But now they have those issues back. So I think it depends who the Democrats put forward. If they put forward someone who's just so, so bad that Trump can still, Trump still may be able to pull it out, but I don't know. I think it's unlikely, but I don't want to make a prediction really until I know who the Democrats are actually going to run. Because right now it's really a tough call.
Yeah, it's really really close between Biden, Warren, and Sanders. So if you look at kind of the long term trends, it does look like we could head towards like a more one party state. Or there could be some political realignment in the future. But as things are now, the demographic trends definitely favor the Democrats. It is interesting to see what direction the Democratic Party, or both parties will go in. So the Democratic Party is going like further in a much further woke direction. And that's an obvious trend, but it's more mysterious what will happen with the Republican Party. Because as you were talking about Trump, it seemed that there was that the Republican Party was going to go into a different direction. But basically all the people, all the politicians, political figures associating with Trump, a lot of them are pretty much like generic, pretty standard Republicans, like you have people like Dan Crenshaw. So there kind of is this energy in the Republican Party that could, not in the Republican Party, but there is this energy where some people might say it might go in a direction towards, say, Tucker Carlson, and a lot of people want him to run. But in the short term, it does seem, and basically the short term, it does seem that the Democrats are continuing to go more radically, basically as woke as possible, and the Republicans are probably continuing like this pretty standard direction. So do you see a continuum of that, or could you see a change and a realignment where one party goes through a complete transformation?
Well, I think that, like, there's some energy, like, in the younger people in the Republican Party to change directions. Not even so much in the Republican Party, but, you know, just kind of more in the far right. There's a lot of energy there to change direction, but I think that, at least in the short term, they don't have any, they have no candidate other than like a few outliers that are like running for Congress or something like that, like people that are kind of, you know, some of the younger people.
Oh yeah, there's a group of these guys running for Congress as Republicans, as like immigration restrictionists and non-interventionist, and I would vote for them if I were in their districts, but the thing is, there's been candidates like that who are basically like paleoconservatives who have ran as Republicans in the past, and it didn't really make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah, and also they're not, you know, they're decades away from where they could be in a position to, you know, being like Secretary of State or, you know, presidential candidates or something. When you look at prominent people that are like, you know, that have these kinds of views, like there's nothing, you know, the closest, you know, high profile person is probably like Jeff Sessions, and he is like an immigration restrictionist, but he's also like an interventionist, kind of like the trade-off that, you know, you talked about before, like the trade-off that you might accept. But these young people that are just like these 30-year-olds and whatnot that are just running for Congress, like they're not even close to the kind of national promise, like prominence, where they would have any real influence in an administration. So like, not only has like Trump been disappointing on the issues that he ran in, but there's no clear heir to his policies when he's gone. You know, like who's going to run in 2024? Like Pence? You know, I mean, he's not any of the things that Trump promised to be, and he's going to be like essentially one of the first, one of the front runners if he decides to.
Yeah, I was
saying,
like the only person I could think of would be Tucker Carlson, and I don't even think he would win. He would just be kind of, I mean, I would vote for Tucker Carlson, but he would just be right, kind of like a protest vote.
He's a commentator, though. He's not like, you know, you're not just going to be like a news commentator and run for president or something like that. I could see, like, if he ran for Congress or something, but, like, you're not going to, you know what I mean? You're not going to be somebody like a TV personality running for president or something. Like, it's just not going to work. Like, even when you had someone like Reagan, like, I mean, he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild and he was governor of California before, you know, before any of that. So it's not like, you know, so yeah, I would probably vote for him too. But in terms of like a national political figure, like there's nobody who is an heir to Trump that is like, you know, who are the front runners for 2024, like Pence and who else, like Ted Cruz, like these people. It's none of the same, or like these Republican like no name governors that are just like completely useless. Like there's nobody who is anything close to like the views of like a Pat Buchanan or Nick Fuentes or any of these. So when some of these younger people, if they get into Congress and they become senators or something like that, then, you know, they will, you know, in 10 years or something, you could see this, but, you know, even some of these people, like, you can't really trust because as soon as they get into office or whatever, they don't necessarily, continue on, you know, because they're still like these politician people, like they're not, you know, you even see so many of these young people, even from these edgier spheres, like rationalizing and making excuses for this stuff when it's like, no, this is like what we're totally against, like this is what, you know, we were trying to change. So you already see them kind of, you know, wiggling and trying to triangulate.
So you made this prediction on Twitter, is that basically people are not going to wake up in any significant numbers to enact any significant change. And most young people, kind of like the frog in the boiling pot cliche, that people will just sort of gradually be conditioned to accept like a lower standard of living. And then there's all the other factor that a lot of people coming in are immigrants from countries where the standard of living is much closer. So there's this whole sort of like idea of a societal collapse, and it's been a sort of a fantasy of political dissidence, like kind of like a Mad Max scenario, going back to like the 90s Patriot Movement types. But I really don't see that happening. I just see like a gradual decline in living and people just sort of gradually getting used to it, and there not being like a massive reaction.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm the kind of person where it's like, you know, I haven't been, you know, succumbed to being like, you know, I'm just going to adapt. This is just like the way things are now. Like, you know, when I go out and when I'm, you know, in public, and there's hordes of third world people. People don't speak English when you're trying to do things. Like, I'm not like okay with that.
In Phoenix, is it primarily like Spanish speaking, or are you getting people from all over the world?
I mean, it's everywhere. My neighborhood has mostly like Indian people, and like I said, the mall that I grew up going to, which, you know, used to be like 95% white, is now filled with like Middle Eastern, like, artifact stores and like, you know, Indian grocery stores and clothing, and like the customers and things like that. Like, you know, I would say like 60 or 70% of them, like, English is their second language, and they're people from, you know, like Asians, Russians, Middle East. It used to be when I was a kid here that it would just be Mexicans, but now it's like from everywhere, almost like when I lived in LA 20 years ago, like that's
yeah, that actually
that's
does
what
make
it's like here now.
That makes sense, because if you're looking at immigration predictions, a lot of like immigration restrictionists will complain about Mexico, but I was looking at this chart. Mexican immigration basically peaked about 20 years ago, and it's declined significantly. Like the biggest increase has been from India.
Yeah, and it's also funny because, like, and this talks about, like, how people, adapt, actually, because, like, or get used to the way things are, is because, like, now when I, like, you know, interact with, like Mexicans and stuff like that, I can relate to them more than, like, these people from India or something that is just, like, completely alien, you know, their cultures and their social norms and whatnot are completely alien to what I'm used to, whereas, like, you know, obviously the Southwest has always had kind of Mexican component to it, and there is some, at least some assimilation there. So it's like, it's almost like kind of like, oh, you know, oh, thank God this person is like, is Mexican, you know, and not from, from wherever. So I can at least kind of, relate to them when I'm trying to do this transaction or whatever. But getting back to you know, what we were talking about is that when I see these young people now that you can tell they've gotten used to it because they're like, you know, there's all of these, like, these kind of foreign celebrities now that are promoted and huge, and even like minority celebrities and whatnot, like, and just foreigners, like Middle Eastern celebrities, and all of these viral songs and memes and these artists. So you see like a young white person, and they're just like, you know, they'll be fascinated with some like rapper or something like that, or some, like, some Middle Eastern rapper. And it'll just be like, it'll be like complete garbage, but they're just like, they're okay with it. And, you know, and I look at some of these performers and stuff, and I'm thinking, like, okay, like, in, like, a civilized society, like, these people would be, like, in cages, like, in a circus. You know, like, this person would be, like, in an exhibit, you know, for, like, at a circus, you know, one of these, like, you know, believe it or not, these fucking freaks. But you have all of these young people that are just, like, even in like the far right, that are just kind of,
oh,
like,
yeah. Well, I haven't even noticed any. So the next generation of people who are now reaching 20, they're Zoomers, but they haven't really created their. There hasn't really been a new innovative youth subculture, because for millennials, like, the last big subculture was the hipsters about 10 to 15 years ago, and then hipster culture kind of exists in a kind of watered down form. But nothing really new has replaced that.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's in a more, like, superficial form now, because, like, you'll see, like, you know, like, 15 or 20 years ago, like, the hipster scene was still, like, very, you know, what I grew up in and what I was, like, immersed in, it was very, like, kind of, like, the arty, pretentious, but like, you know, kind of, like, implicitly white.
It kind of got merged with these other, like, kind of reality TV douchebag culture and just kind of pop culture.
Right. So continuing on, like, what you see now is, like, I will see a girl or something that, like, aesthetically, like, she looks, like, hip, right? But then, like, she will, like, you know, she'll listen to, like Halsey or, like, one of these mainstream, like, just any of these, like, you know, these rapper people that are just, like, you know, just complete, you know, for lack of a better term, just, like, degenerate, like, illiterate garbage, you know. And it's like, so it's like that you could see that girl and they'll, like, she'll look like a hipster, but, like, you know, 15 years ago, you would have seen a girl that looked like that, and she would have been into all of this, like, obscure old records and, like, Velvet Underground and, like, you know, like, kind of high-minded art and whatnot. But now you see, like, a girl with, you know, that has a hipster look that she's got, she looks cool, but then when you talk to her, you realize that, like, you know, her interests are just the same, like, kind of all of this just garbage and, like, basic shit.
Yeah, and back to the theme of, like, gradually getting used to the decline, is there's this whole kind of concept of, I read this on some leftist site calling it plutocratic socialism or oligarchic socialism, but I've heard right-wing populists discuss the same concept, and there is this kind of concern about that with Yang and the UBI. Not so much that Yang wants this, but that could be a possible outcome where the plutocracy basically loots all the wealth under automation, and then basically everyone does get a modest basic income UBI of 1,000 a month, but that basically the standard of living of the average person is very low, and they just have enough to take care of their basic needs. Plus, they'll be kind of sucked into entertainment, so just enough to kind of make it profitable for the corporations and media outlets, but basically a very low standard of living. But people will be living off these basic incomes with very low quality of life, and it will be basically impossible to go beyond that, and basically like no middle class. So it's kind of been described as plutocratic socialism, and you're already kind of starting to see this trend happening in California.
Yeah, totally. And you see it with like, and this is kind of where Yang sort of went down the tubes, is like promoting like the idea of, you know, people living in shipping containers and like these pods, you know, these pods that people live in, and like LA and stuff that, you know, that you're supposed to be like, okay, because this is how we're going to adapt to the new, you know, having fucking billions of people here. And all of that, and this is going to be like the 21st century, as opposed to just like, you know, not having that many people here and having open space and like people being able to buy land and do things. Like, they're just going to like pack them in with sardines, and it's just like these people are like are okay with this stuff. Now, I personally, you know, just me personally, like, I don't have a problem with things like micro apartments, because like I lead a very like minimalist lifestyle. But I can also see what they're doing here.
Yeah, so some conservatives will flat out, like, they'll just get really hysterical. And that's UN Agenda 21. Like, any type of talk of high-density housing is UN Agenda 21. But I do think the issue is, I do support micro-apartments, but it shouldn't be sort of, like, pressured on people. Like, people shouldn't be forced to, like, dramatically lower their quality of life. That's the issue.
Well, and also, like, you know, you and I are artists, so, like, people who are artists are going to seek out these, like, puny lofts and things like that, because we're, you know, that's the kind of lifestyle we live. But but the idea of making this sort of thing the norm for, like, young urban professionals and, you know, people that should be starting family, people that would be, you know, in the 60s or the 80s, you know, they would have been being able to buy a huge ass house for like $50,000 or $60,000, like the idea that those people are now going to have to live in like a pod if they're living in any major city, like that's kind of insulting. But these young people are not used to it, and then there's always this. You'll notice that, like, this is something you don't hear this so much anymore, but like 5 or 10 years ago, you know, people would, whenever you complain about something or how something works or how it's inefficient, people would say like, oh, you know, those are first world problems, you know, as if like you shouldn't be concerned about something because like, oh, you know, that's a first world problem. But like, one of the reasons that we live in a first world country is that because we're constantly trying to make things more efficient and improve.
Yeah, it's technology. I think that's a really idiotic meme. I think it is important to have high standards.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I don't want to lower my standards to something like India and whatnot. And then you have the same kinds of people that always say, well, like, oh, you know, these are the jobs that Americans won't do, so they are, or you can't, Americans can't compete. And, like, you know, can't compete in this sense means that, like, if some Indian comes over here, they're, like, you know, they're willing to live, like, 8 people to a room or something like that, and they and work for nothing. Well, yeah, I can't compete with that because I don't want to lower my standard of living to that. Like, doesn't mean I'm, like, not as good at the job or something. It means that, like, in an economic sense, like, yeah, I'm not willing to do it as cheaply as they are. I'm not willing to accept the same low standard of living. Like, that's why these corporations want them here, is because they're willing to accept a lower standard of living and, like, poorer labor conditions and, you know, like, lower wages. And they're, of course, if they're people who have a slave mentality and they're willing to work without, you know, if they're willing to work without complaining and whatnot, then it's like, yeah, of course, that's basically a slave mentality, though.
And one trend we'll definitely see is that those who are well off, they'll find more advanced ways of isolating themselves, basically beyond just moving to the suburbs or into gated community. Someone on Twitter posted this image. It's in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and it's like you see the massive slums or favelas on one side. But it's the thing is, it was remarkable at this place. It's not like your generic gated community. It's like a, it's basically like a series of high rises and kind of like a resort. So more like a self-contained city. But you see this in a lot of these different countries with a lot of inequality and crime, places like Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico. And I do predict that we'll start to see that in this future, but it'll go beyond just like a gated community, like more kind of like an urban arcology that we talk about, but places for kind of like the wealthier to isolate themselves from a lot of these problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And you even see, like, I think some of that stuff here in terms of like these home delivery services and things like that, where people can, you know, even with Amazon, all of that kind of stuff is related because people can really live their lives kind of totally away from all of this stuff. And it's basically like, you know, you get to where you go, where you leave the house, if you're like, you know, you can live on like one of these higher floors or something, and you don't have to deal with the riffraff. You can get your food ordered, or, you know, when you
or there'll
you
be like
your
a
car,
drone
your car
deliveries will be a thing
complex, and then, you know, you drive out into the zombie apocalypse, but like, you know, it's just you're making like a 10-minute excursion through there or something, you know.
So
what
basically
I mean? So
there'll be no like practical need to go out to the grocery store to go shopping. People will still, there'll be like shopping dining districts purely as entertainment zones, places to go out on like a Friday or Saturday night just for the experience, but there won't be any practical reasons to. So I don't, that's kind of interesting with these trends, because there is this trend in urbanism towards more walkable communities, but that could actually impede that trend. It's possible people might become more insular and spend more time indoors, and that could possibly have a negative impact on urbanism. That combined with the whole like the homeless issues gotten really out of control, and then people are being able to deliver everything, so that could counter the trend towards more urban walkable communities.
Well, yeah, because the problem is when they have been pushing this urbanism and walkable communities and whatnot, but at the same time they've been too open about diversity and homelessness and like street harassment and like and crime and stuff. So it's like even those places like Portland, which were you know, kind of thought of as like Whitetopias, like maybe 10 years ago or something like that. Even then, those are kind of like shitty places to, you know, to walk around in. And what in like, you know, San Francisco, obviously, and, you know, Los Angeles is, you know, the more like gentrified parts of it. It's kind of like, so it's hurting the urbanism because like, having these walkable communities, but if you're not doing anything about like the crackheads that are like shitting on the sidewalk and like, you know, harassing you for money or just like talking shit, you know, beating people up, then it's like eventually like those urbanists, and you see that in Phoenix too, because downtown Phoenix has been went through a gentrification process about 15 years ago, and it became like a hip kind of place to, you know, real artsy, but at the same time with like the diversity and everything, like that the area still has like a strong like ghetto component to it. And there was like two workers at a, you know, hipster coffee shop called Jobot that were murdered by like illegals or something, like executed, like, you know, for they were robbed and like murdered, like walking home from work in the arts district. And it's just kind of an example of this kind of like cognitive dissonance where you like,
I think the whole issue with the homelessness, I think it will probably get, the next decade, it will get much worse. And I don't think there'll be like some kind of public consensus. I just think people will find ways to kind of get around it. Like more companies will like find solutions dealing with like private security. There isn't really any unified plan that could fix this.
Yeah, and like, I mean, the people that run those, like, they're not like, they're not going to bring out the like the scoops like they had in Soylent Green, you know, where they have these construct, just like scoop people off and just move them off and just clear it out. But so it's like,
well, yeah, the left is gonna pose like any kind of police crackdown. There's that issue, but then the other issue is a lot of people are not willing to find some kind of like permanent housing. So the conservative side will prevent any kind of like permanent housing solution, but then the left will prevent any kind of police crackdown on civil liberty grounds.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, a lot of the people that are homeless and like that, like, they're not like necessarily looking for a better life or to, you know, people have this kind of idealized version of like a homeless person as like, just need to get back on my feet, you know, going through a rough couple months. Like, whereas like, you know, if the reality is a lot of these people, like, they don't want to work, or they're criminals, they're insane, they're like surly, and they just are not like, you know, this idea that like, oh, we just need to like feed and clothe them. It's like, you know, there's more going on than just that. Like someone that like needs to catch a break. Like
with the whole topic of isolating yourselves, like in a kind of self-contained city, we've talked about that theme with dissidents, political or cultural dissidents, doing that in a kind of neo-tribal society where a group can sort of form their own community with one of these self-contained cities. But the problem is that like dissidents, they lack the wealth, but they also lack the social capital. In order to accomplish something, you either need a lot of wealth or you need to be really well socially connected in a more kind of organic tribal community. And I don't really see dissidents being able to do that in a short term. And we also talked about this issue on the show we did about Yang and the UBI. But the thing is, like, with the UBI, like, a bunch of people could get together and move out to a remote area and buy like one building and kind of share that, but it would be something very modest. Like I am pessimistic, at least in the short term, of dissidents being able to create anything like that.
It's only going to be the super rich that are doing that, you know, ironically the same people that are like insistent on like bringing in millions of people and like having people live in shipping, like they're going to be the ones who are able to isolate themselves. And that reminds me of a different thing as we see, like, you know, the U.S. heading more and more towards a late stage empire situation. Is like at toward the end of the Roman Empire, that the people lived in like fortified towns, and they had like fortified cities and like towns that they lived in, you know, that were you know, to keep out barbarians and things like that. So as opposed to just having the whole country, they ended up, you know, having these fortified cities, living in these fortified cities. And so you can see those patterns kind of emerging now. Of course, the problem with the U.S. is that, you know, I mean, people can go anywhere. Like, if you show up to a town, people can't be like, oh, you can't move here, or like, you can't come in, you know, we're not going to open the gate. So the equivalent to that is like, I guess, would be like these gated communities, which like we've talked about, are going to become more autonomous and more restrictive as they simply have to be. That's going to be kind of a selling point of living at these places. Is like, oh, you can dine here, you can shop here. We already have like apartment complexes where they have like a built-in, like, you know, Starbucks type place, the cafe.
With these different trends in urbanism, the blogger DK on Twitter, who I did a written interview with him on the Stark Truth, he has these trends on urbanism. So I'll read a few of them so that urban-suburban prediction for the next decade, more mixed-use developments and more AUD and townhouses. And yeah, we're already seeing that. And yeah, surface parking lots will disappear, being replaced with mid-rise buildings with underground parking garages. Yeah, we're already seeing that as well. I do think like self-driving cars will revolutionize parking, but that's probably further off. I don't really see self-driving cars in the next decade, maybe 20 to 30 years away. They do have these like automized parking garages, which that actually is a trend to look out for, and that will make like land use and parking a lot more efficient, these automized parking structures. Yeah, no high-speed trains in the U.S. and self-driving cars having certain limited appeals. I support high-speed rail, but if it does happen, it would probably take about like 30 to 40 years to complete, and by then we'll have self-driving cars, so who knows what will happen with high-speed rail. I mean, at the very minimum, they should invest more in Amtrak and improve that, and a lot of Amtrak trains are very slow with delays, so I do see the trend is I don't really see that much happening with high-speed rail in the United States. Like light rail and subway construction, that actually is a big thing. Like LA is rapidly expanding their metro, and well, Phoenix too. A lot of these different Elon Musk's boring company might build some underground highways and only allow electric vehicles or autonomous vehicles. So yeah, who knows? That might take off. And he predicted retail. The majority of goods will be online, ordered online and delivered. Storefronts that will close. So yeah. We discussed that, but I do think as more goods are delivered online and delivered, we will see massive numbers of storefronts close down, and that could end up having a really destructive impact on urban life. He predicts gentrification will continue, and yeah, I do see gentrification. It is a major trend, but I wonder if the whole issue with the homelessness could impede on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because and also like the impact that so many retail establishments closing is going to have.
That will contribute to a lot of urban blight. And also another thing is, if you just look at these kind of like long-term demographic trends, will probably have an impact on the viability of gentrification as well.
Yeah, and there's like with the disappearance of these retail jobs and the factory jobs, like they're. There's at a certain point, there's like, what is there going to be left for, ordinary people in the community to just have jobs? I mean, there's like, even like the customer service stuff is like, so much of that is outsourced now to other countries. So, and like telemarketing is all automated now. So you don't even really see that other than like, people trying to sell to these businesses and whatnot. So it's like, I mean, we're not all going to be programmers and whatnot, and of course the programmers are they're outsourcing that stuff and bringing people in from India. So it's like that's kind of where you'll see more of, I think, this like the gig economy, because like what else are you supposed to do but do like odd jobs for people online? There's nothing you can't all be heard. Like what industries are even less unless you have a trade or something like air conditioning repair or something like that. But, a lot of those things are fairly limited, like they're not, you're talking about like millions and millions of jobs disappearing. It's not, you can't be like, oh, well, we're all going to be plumbers or something like that. Like there's not a demand for, for that many of these other kinds of jobs.
Yeah, you're already seeing a lot of the impacts with automation. And it's one of the, Yang has brought this up, it's one of the factors that a lot of malls are closing down because of Amazon. And in Decay's predictions, he talks about how a lot of these malls are closing down and they're building hotels and apartments on the parking lots. And a lot of the anchor stores, they're converting malls into office space. So that's happening with Horton Plaza in San Diego and Westside Pavilion in LA. They're being converted into other uses.
And yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen it here too.
Another trend in urbanism is we've sort of talked about this in the show, like the NIMBYism and the restrictions, but there has been this push to sort of abolish exclusively single-family zoning. So that is a bill that like conservative NIMBYs have been really outraged about, this proposal in Virginia. I guess the way how the left frames it, because so the whole thing about like NIMBYism versus YIMBYism, it's a totally relevant issue because there is this massive shortage of housing. But I do think a lot of people on the left will kind of associate, they'll take this issue and tie it in with basically targeting like middle class white suburbs, and they'll talk about diversifying them, and then that will create a backlash from right wingers. So it kind of just creates this really toxic dichotomy from both sides, as opposed to how we would discuss these issues.
Right, and you know, my feeling with a lot of this increased housing density and stuff is like, you know, I've always lived in cities, so it's like it's not a big deal to me. But at the same time, it's like, you know, why don't we address the issue of like why these cities are so crowded that you have to be packed in like sardines? Like why, you know, why don't like I would rather there. That we have like a smaller population where things are more open, and then like real estate prices will go down because like you know, there's more land. It's kind of like you know, like I don't necessarily want to be like Tokyo or something where we're all, you know, there's 8 zillion people in the city and you're just kind of like cramped into this little like cubbyhole.
Yeah, I understand that argument about like population growth, but the problem with NIMBYism is they'll put restrictions on new housing, and then mass immigration will put further strains. So then just regular millennials who are like Americans from middle class backgrounds, they'll be basically screwed from both ends, from the mass immigration side and from the NIMBY side.
Well, I agree, but I think that the area to address then is the root cause, which is the mass immigration.
Well, the thing, I agree with that, but here's the thing is like, there's no, basically all powerful special interests in this nation are dedicated to mass immigration. Well, there are powerful special interests, including like a lot of the left wing of the Democratic Party and a lot of corporations that are friendly to the YIMBY argument. So, ideally we would combine like a modest degree of YIMBYism with immigration restriction, but there's absolutely no viable political entity for that.
You know, I completely agree, and I think that that's what ties into my prediction that people are more likely to just willing to accept, you know, adapt to a lower standard and be like, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to make like a falling down movie kind of stand here. I'm just going to be like, okay, well, I'm just going to have them build these new micro apartments then and move in there, because that's how I'm going to afford to live in this city.
In the foreseeable future, do you predict that the woke lunacy will continue to get even more extreme?
I think it's going to get even more insane. I mean, you can see like, you know, in our circles, we're kind of in a, I think we're in a bubble, you know, where you think like everyone thinks this stuff is a joke, and you know, no support. But it, like in the mainstream, like there are 20 candidates in the Democratic primary, and every single one of them is on board with like 99% of that shit. You know, like if you went to all the Democratic candidates and were like, oh, you know, should your child be able to choose their gender, or like should transgender people be able to adopt, like they would all like all be on board with every fucking freaky Tumblr thing. Even when people, like normal people, like roll their eyes and about that kind of stuff, like,
and another thing is like, I remember a while back a lot of dissident rightists had this kind of fantasy scenario about Zoomers being a lot more based and red pill. But that's complete nonsense. I think all the polls show that like the youngest people are the most furthest left views.
Well, yeah, and especially like younger whites. I think that these people conflate some of these stats when they say like, oh, look, you know, younger people are starting to turn against abortion and are starting to become more religious. It's like, well, yeah, that's because you have people moving here from fucking Somalia and like the Middle East and things like that. And like the, you know what I mean? Like, so that's what's skewing the numbers, is that you have the population is coming from all of these like backward third world places. So they do have, you know, and so it's kind of like, I think the trend is going to continue, because you don't see, even though like in our circle or something, you know, all of that stuff is so, I mean, it's so fucking freaky that it's just ridiculous. But in the normal area, like, even if people roll their eyes about it, they still will, they still vote for candidates who promote that stuff. And not only that, but they still, you know, whenever someone, you know, whenever it's time to like, you know, I hate to use this term, but like virtue signal or something, that will like, they pile right on, you know, when someone is like, oh, you know, this person said a transphobic thing, you look on Twitter or something, like, you know, that tweet will have like 250,000 likes, whereas like something that is like, you know, someone having like a sane take on it, like in our circles, like it'll be popular, but it'll have like what, like 500 likes or something. And so it's like, it's not, you know, once you get out of this bubble, you realize that like how much people have just absorbed all of this completely bonkers shit. And I don't see that changing, because there's not anyone really with the courage to do something about it. I don't see it changing in the near future. I think that eventually, like, it's not sustainable. But you know, I think that the idea, like, Gamergate was like 6 years ago, and now things like have gone even further.
Yeah, I can't predict the distant future. It's not sustainable in the long term, but in the next decade, the 2020s, it will get much more insane. As far as American nationalism goes, we've discussed a lot in this show about a post-American future. How long do you think conservatives will cling on to this idea of Americanism?
I don't know. I think probably a long time, you know, because they're very wedded to it. And you know, you see this even in the kind of like red-pilled dissident community, where they think, oh, you know, how are these people like, you know, like supporting Iran in this conflict, or, you know, rather than their own country, like America. Well, you know, to me, like, at this point, America exists in like name only. So like what we're seeing here, and what some of these people haven't abandoned yet, is like, you know, we're seeing a loyalty to a people and to tribes rather than to this abstract America, which, you know, which doesn't represent, you know, doesn't represent us in any significant fashion anymore. So when like these kind of these woke POC people, like the, you know, the Squad and that, like when they say like, you know, white man, this isn't your country anymore. Well, when I look around, like, I can see like, yeah, they're right. I'm looking at my neighborhood here. This isn't my fucking country anymore. Like, and so, and if you look at the people, you know, they don't demonstrate any willingness to, you know, oh, you know, we're going to take it back. There's just nothing there. If you look at any of the responses to this stuff, like, what do they call, like, Colin Kaepernick? Their response is to call Colin Kaepernick, like, a racist, or, you know, try to get, you know, Kanye, you know, to help get the black vote or something for the GOP. So, you know, what we're seeing here is we're seeing a, among some people, you know, we're seeing that those who are seeing more of we're seeing a loyalty to our people, which is why they're like more supportive of Russia and these other countries, because it's about the people and not these abstract things like the American flag and whatnot. So I think people will continue to cling to that, because I think you're going to have a segment of people that are saying like, no, you know, like, I'm an American, like, and, you know, we should fight for this. And then there's also the people that are just going to, that are so believing in the idea of American and Democrats are the real racists and things like that, that they're going to be like, they already accept the new definition of America. And
it's kind of, if we look at past trends, like a Republican today has kind of social values of like a 90s Democrat, like a Bill Clinton Democrat. So maybe a Republican in 30 years from now would be, I don't know, would be more like, who knows, like the social values of Elizabeth Warren even?
I don't really know. Or they're just going to be like, they're going to try to appeal to the social conservatism of like these Middle Eastern people and things that come in. You know what I mean? So they're going to try and approach these people from that angle, like abortion and these other issues that are going to, they're going to try to appeal to them in those kinds of ways, like pro family and things like that. So I could see that sort of thing, but I think that for people like you and me, there's a realization that like we already live in a post-American situation.
And a lot of it has to do with where I grew up. So people who grew up in places in the Midwest where changes happened more recently, but they grew up in an environment where they felt, yeah, this is the real America. I already kind of grew up in LA in a kind of post-American environment. So, I mean, I grew up
totally.
In multiculturalism, so I already kind of had that. I never really got into this idea that I felt really part of America.
Yeah, I totally agree. And like, if someone, you know, lives in like in a suburb in Iowa or like a suburb in Wisconsin or you know, Oklahoma or something like that, then you know, I could see how they would think like, oh, you know, if we just need to restrict immigration and preserve America and stuff. But if you like live in places like we did, like Phoenix or Los Angeles or something, like, you know, I look around and I'm just like, okay, well, you know, like I look around, like it's over, at least in this area. So like, I'm already looking for the escape pod. You know what I mean? Like I'm looking for the escape hatch. And that's why
with immigration trends, like it's always been that America has been a destination for immigrants. But one trend I do predict is that you'll start to actually see like upper class Americans leave the country and go into places like New Zealand or Australia.
Yeah, and I think I wrote about that in my predictions thread. Also, is that you're going to, like, the American refugee is going to start to become a thing where, you know, Americans will move to like Poland and these other kind of places if they can, like if they have money, or they'll move to Japan or things like that. Like, you know, I always kind of fantasize about like if I had the money, you know, moving to like one of these islands, like Catalina Island or something, you know, something that's like, fairly isolated and whatnot. And I think that where you and I, you grew up in our experiences in these very kind of post-American, like ultra diverse areas, as I think that it's kind of led us to come up with these kind of bizarre, more creative,
out of the box solutions. So yeah, I mean, even though we talked about like the impracticality of a self-contained city and how that needs massive resources, and it's kind of more practical for the wealthy. And that's probably like the absolute best case. That's like the absolute best case solution that is viable, and even that's extremely difficult.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I've been looking to write about or write a book on is this idea of like purchasing a private island and creating kind of a de facto, city state out of it. And I think that like, you know, that I think is like, these are the kinds of solutions that people could be looking for. Like I think I've often thought about it jokingly as, you know, that like, you know, people should buy that like Epstein Island, you know, and like, as soon as I'm reading it up, it has like its own like desalination, like water plant and things like that. And it's like 70 acres. So it would be enough to make like a big, So it's like, you know, that's one of my ideas is I think that, like, you know, these dissidents need to get more creative than other than like, oh, we're going to red pill the normies and like take it. Like, it's like, no, you should be like pooling your money together.
And I think it's the whole idea. I just think it's really ridiculous. Like the failure of Trump was this idea that it's a failure that you can win over the masses. So what happened is they did get the majority of the vote, but that doesn't matter because the same elites were in place. I think the key issue is not winning over the masses, but building like new elites. It's better to sort of be part of a small elite group than to try to win over everyone.
Yeah, and I think this is the problem that I have with a lot of like, you know, people that are kind of like neo-colonialists or like supporter, like we need to, you know, build a new fascist empire or something like that, is I think like, you know, okay, but like if you do that, then that means that you have to like placate all of these people and like, you know, you have to live with them. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I want to get away from these people. Like, I want to escape. You know, and like, you know, be walled off from them, not like, you know, not have to persuade these people who can't even like read a coupon, like persuade them to red pill them and whatnot. Like, it's like, you know, but all power to, I don't want to like rule over them. I think that when another prediction I have for the future is that what we see and what we see even now is that, you know, these huge empires of the past, the 20th century and before that, we live in a time now with technology where people can be very, like a small group of people can be very powerful with, like in Silicon Valley or something, without a lot of geographical area or like, you know, the point that I'm trying to make is that having like more people or more land in the 21st century doesn't necessarily translate to more power the way it did 100 years ago when you had, you know, 50,000 tanks or something like that. You know, it's kind of like the way the military, it's like one nuclear bomb could wipe out like one thing. That's kind of like, that's also kind of how like the economic power and things like that have shifted, you know, in the elites is where, so you're almost like better with a kind of,
like there was that article by Matt Iglesias, these people who say that America needs to have a billion people in order to remain a superpower. Like the sheer numbers of people really don't matter.
Yeah, no, they really don't. And also, you know, rather than this kind of massive federated like Soviet Union style empire, like I envision something more.
Oh, successful. Like that idea, like a Euro-Siberia, that would be like the United States, Russia, and Europe, like one empire?
Yeah, like I envision something more along the lines of like the kind of Spectre organization from like the old James Bond things, where it's kind of like this powerful, you know, international, you know, economic / you know, in those books it's like it's a criminal kind of terrorist organization, but you know, but the principle of just this kind of small, very powerful group that is, you know, basically isolated from the rest of things, but still had like wields like a tremendous amount of power, you know? And you see that with some of these, like, these tech conglomerates and whatnot, like, you know, they, you know, someone like Elon Musk or like, you know, Google or one of these, like they can easily, you know, create their own, autonomous kind of, you know, and you actually could have a situation where, you know, some kind of Trump-like figure was a billionaire or something, or was just like, you know what, I'm going to buy this island and I'm going to create my own kind of tropical state here, and it's going to be like secluded. It's almost kind of like an Ayn Rand type thing, but I think it's more of a it's not a reaction to socialism or anything like that, but more of a reaction to just kind of like the decline and like the lack of like the loss of civilization.
We're at the end of the show. Brandon Adamson, I'd like to thank you for being on. It's really, really fascinating topics, and it'll be interesting to see if any of them will come true in the next decade.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And, you know, my final prediction is that like everything is going to get shittier for the next few years. And I probably won't even live another 5 to 10 years. So, but those are my predictions.